1. Ground Zero. Cromford, England, 1771. 250 years ago, a man called Richard Arkwright sparked a revolution. No violence was involved, there was no blood. The sun shone as if nothing had happened, but its rising and setting bookended a day that changed the world forever. Arkwright, originally a lowly barber, wig maker, and tooth puller from Preston, Lancashire, had a big idea and put it to work in the small Derbyshire village of Cromford, just down the road from my home up here in the Peak District. Having made a tidy bit of cash as a result of a waterproof dye he had invented for wigs, Arkwright developed an interest in the cotton industry, which was burgeoning at the time, especially in Lancashire. A canny operator, he was quick to see that making yarn by hand, using an apparatus known as the spinning jenny, could never keep up with the huge and growing demand for the product. His big idea was to develop and patent a mechanized spinning device known as the water frame. Not only could this make yarn more speedily, but the product was also stronger and of better quality. Traditionally, women spun the yarn and their menfolk wove it into cloth, all within the confines of small cottages. But Arkwright's invention changed all this. The water frame spinning machines were far too big to fit into a home, and, as the name testifies, they needed flowing water to operate. Arkwright's solution was to construct a large building close to the River Derwent to host his spinning machines and power them by means of water wheels. The new facility looked just like a watermill used to make flour from grain and soon became known simply as Cromford Mill. Spinners and weavers living in Cromford Village, close by the new installation, saw their lives change overnight. Instead of spinning at home, the women, and children as young as 7 too, now headed every day to the mill to produce yarn using the water frames, while the men stayed at home to weave the yarn into cloth. At a stroke, Arkwright and his partners Samuel Need and Jedediah Strutt had unleashed mass manufacturing on an unsuspecting world. To squeeze the most out of his workers, Arkwright instigated a system of overlapping 13-hour shifts with bells at 5 a.m. and 5 p.m. to rouse the unfortunate women and children and set them commuting, bleary-eyed, down the steep hill from their homes to the mill. Nothing less than a modern, mechanized factory system was up and running. The mechanization of work previously undertaken by individuals or small groups, using human muscle and dexterity alone, spread like wildfire in the years that followed. Arkwright himself built new mills along the Derwent, in Lancashire and Scotland. Soon, the arrival of steam power freed new developments from needing access to flowing water, and new factories were built for the mass production of glass, chemicals, and machine tools, such as lathes and steam hammers. Machine tool production boosted the revolution in work and manufacturing even further, so that within decades, a national economy, previously entirely reliant upon manual labor, was transformed beyond all recognition. Steam-powered machine technology revolutionized textile production, coal refining, metalworking, and a multitude of other enterprises. At the same time, an explosion of new roads, canals, and railway lines broadcast the revolution into every corner of the UK, and eventually far beyond its borders. Arkwright's revolution, born on that sunny Derbyshire day in 1771, was nothing less than the Industrial Revolution. In the century that followed, a tsunami of mechanization and mass production swept across Europe and North America, destroying one way of life and replacing it with another, a seemingly unstoppable wave of change that continues to roar across the face of our planet today. Arkwright's legacy. The work of the former wig maker is recognized at the highest level by the fact that Arkwright's original Cromford Mill and the others built in the late 18th century upon the banks of the River Derwent now constitute a UNESCO World Heritage Site, marking the unequivocal birthplace of the Industrial Revolution. Arkwright's legacy is widely hailed as a colossal achievement of immense benefit to humankind, and so it is in many ways, but it also comes at enormous cost. As Arkwright's baby has grown and developed, it has become an unstoppable beast. Increasingly, and in particular since the end of the Second World War, the wigmakers' revolution has underpinned a global economy governed by a conspiracy of largely unfettered, free-market capitalism and a desperate and growing urge to consume. This has driven an immeasurable rise in the quality of life in many countries. At the same time, however, billions have remained mired in poverty, while the gap between the haves and have-nots grows ever wider. The consequences of market-driven consumerism have also been dire, with widespread pollution, the large-scale degradation and destruction of the environment, and an overheating planet the result. A straight line can be drawn, then, from the opening of Arkwright's Cromford Mill to the ongoing climate and ecological emergency, the greatest existential threat our civilization has ever faced. As far as climate change is concerned, the small Derbyshire village of Cromford is nothing less than ground zero. Here, in other words, is where all our problems began. The climate emergency. How did we get here? Time was, people were content to have what they needed for a good life. Now, it seems, at least in the industrialized nations, that we can never have too much stuff. On our tiny planet, a society based upon ever more consumption of rapidly diminishing resources cannot be sustained, which is why we find ourselves, today, in the midst of a climate and ecological crisis. When Arkwright opened his mill 250 years ago, the concentration of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere was 280 parts per million, ppm. Carbon dioxide is the principal greenhouse gas, which acts to keep our planet warm and helps shield it from the bitter cold of space. But too much of it can lead to a dangerous rise in global temperature. The level of carbon dioxide goes up and down over geological time in response to natural processes. A level of 280 ppm is, for example, near enough what you would expect in the current interglacial period during which human civilization has burgeoned. At the height of the last ice age, just 20,000 years ago, levels fell to around 180 ppm, and they would do so again during the next ice age, if it isn't kept at bay by humankind's adulteration of the atmosphere. This is because Arkwright's legacy is not only the creation of an economic wonder capable of meeting all our wants and needs, but a prodigious exhalation of pollution that has seen an additional 2.4 trillion tons of carbon dioxide added to our planet's atmosphere. This raised levels in 2021 to a high of 420 ppm, a hike of 50%, bringing with it a global average temperature rise of 1.2 degrees Celsius and an increasingly obvious upsurge in extreme weather events as our once stable climate starts to break down. Perhaps the most depressing thing about the growing climate emergency is that we've been put on notice time and time again about the potentially catastrophic impact of rising greenhouse gas levels in the atmosphere, but we've repeatedly refused to listen and chosen not to act. No one can say we weren't warned. Way back in 1856, the US scientist Eunice Foote wrote a paper describing the astonishing heat-absorbing properties of carbon dioxide. The paper was based upon the results of a simple but effective experiment, which involved placing two jars, one filled with air and the other with carbon dioxide, in full sun. The jar filled with carbon dioxide heated up much more than the air-filled one, leading Foote to conclude that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere would absorb the sun's heat in the same way. She even speculated that if the air had mixed with it a higher proportion of carbon dioxide than at present, an increased temperature would result. This was, effectively, the first prediction of global warming, made more than 150 years ago. A few years on, in the 1860s, the Irish scientist John Tyndall took Foote's work further. On the basis of hundreds of experiments on the properties of a range of gases, Tyndall noted that variations in the level of atmospheric carbon dioxide, along with water vapor and methane, both also greenhouse gases, must produce a change of climate. Fast forward to the end of the 19th century, and we find Swedish physicist Svante Arrhenius laying the groundwork for modern ideas that link carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere and global temperature. Arrhenius recognized that a halving of carbon dioxide levels could explain the fall in temperature associated with an ice age. He also forecast that a doubling of carbon dioxide levels would result in the global average temperature climbing by 5 to 6 degrees Celsius, a figure he later revised downwards to 4 degrees Celsius. The amount by which our planet will warm for a doubling of the atmospheric carbon dioxide level compared to Arkwright's time is known as the climate sensitivity. Even today, there is considerable debate about how high this number is, with estimates mainly ranging from 1.5 degrees Celsius to 4 degrees Celsius. Most recently, climate models have coalesced around a figure of around 3.7 degrees Celsius, astonishingly close to Arrhenius' prediction. During the 20th century, it slowly became clear that not only could increasing levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide warm the planet, but this was actually happening. In the late 1930s, the British engineer and amateur climate scientist Guy Callender demonstrated that both land temperatures and carbon dioxide levels had risen over the course of the previous 50 years and proposed that the two were linked. Callender's ideas were met with widespread skepticism, but later studies proved him to be spot on. In the 1950s, the Canadian physicist Gilbert Plass examined the links between increasing carbon emissions due to human activities and global temperatures more closely. In an especially prophetic interview with Time magazine in 1953, he's quoted as saying, "At its present rate of increase, the CO2 in the atmosphere will raise the Earth's average temperature 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit every 100 years. For centuries to come, if man's industrial growth continues, the Earth's climate will continue to grow warmer." While this initial estimate of the rate of temperature increase is much too low, the quote still points to an extraordinary level of farsightedness. Plass later went on to forecast that the value of climate sensitivity would be 3.6 degrees Celsius and that atmospheric carbon dioxide levels in 2000 would be 30% higher than in 1900, pushing up the global average temperature by 1 degree Celsius. As previously mentioned, the current estimate of climate sensitivity is 3.7 degrees Celsius, while atmospheric carbon levels in 2000 were actually 37% up on 100 years earlier, leading to warming of around 0.7 degrees Celsius. These, then, are amazingly impressive predictions. In 1956, another US scientist called Roger Revell, working in the same field, testified before Congress that Earth was a spaceship which, due to increasing carbon emissions, was threatened by rising sea levels and desertification. An article describing Revell's research, published the following year, used the term global warming for the first time, concluding that Revell's findings pointed to large-scale global warming with the potential to cause radical climate changes. After the 1950s, research linking global warming with carbon dioxide emissions and their ever-increasing accumulation in the atmosphere moved fast. Most critically, in 1961, US scientist Charles Keeling demonstrated that carbon dioxide levels were climbing incrementally but steadily year on year. He used his measurements to define what has become known as the Keeling curve, a graph that continues to record the remorseless rise of atmospheric CO2 from 315 ppm when Keeling began his measurements to 420 ppm in 2021. As understandings of what was happening gathered pace, so too did the urgency of the warnings. In 1966, the US Nobel laureate chemist Glenn Seaborg cautioned that the rate at which carbon dioxide was being added to the atmosphere, 6 billion tons a year at the time, could lead to marked changes to the climate that could be beyond our control. A couple of years on, a Stanford University report written for the American Petroleum Institute in 1968 flagged the seriousness of global warming, concluding that significant temperature changes were almost certain to occur by the year 2000 and that these could bring about climatic changes. This publication is especially notable in that it was completely ignored by the fossil fuel industry that commissioned it. Not only did it take no action whatsoever, but in the decades that followed, oil companies launched a multi-million dollar drive of obfuscation and denial designed to sow confusion and undermine public confidence in climate science and stymie the need for urgent action to tackle global warming. Notwithstanding frigid scare stories in the tabloids that a new ice age was on the way, support for the idea of global warming and its link to carbon emissions continued to build within the climate science community throughout the 1970s and into the 1980s. In a seminal presentation to the U.S. Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources in 1988, illustrious climate scientist James Hansen, who at the time was working for NASA, warned that global warming was happening now and was without doubt a consequence of escalating greenhouse gas emissions. Hansen's testimony is widely recognized as being a pivotal moment that marked the beginning of the global warming policy debate that continues today. At a stroke, it also ensured that awareness of the threat escaped from its climate science silo and entered the public arena, wherein its profile has grown ever since. As the broader ramifications became increasingly clear, the term global warming was replaced, at least in scientific and technical circles, by climate change. This updated terminology was important as it broadened the focus of debate from what was happening to our planet, a steady rise in global temperature due to carbon emissions, to incorporate the consequences of warming, the large-scale modification of our climate. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Unfortunately, more widespread knowledge and understanding of our changing climate has only translated very slowly, too slowly, into action. The same year as Hansen's testimony, the World Meteorological Organization established the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, with the aim of evaluating climate change science, coordinating research findings, and promoting wider understanding of climate change. To this day, the IPCC remains the arbiter of climate science, and when it comes to understanding and recording what is happening to our climate, its assessment reports engender almost biblical reverence. The panel's principal operational objective is to provide governments at all levels with scientific information that they can use to develop climate policies. To say that the formulation of such policies has taken place at a snail's pace would, in all honesty, be insulting to mollusks. When the IPCC's first assessment report was published in 1990, today's younger climate scientists and politicians were still at infant school, or even babes in arms. The report noted, with certainty, that emissions arising from human activities were substantially increasing the atmospheric concentrations of the greenhouse gases carbon dioxide, methane, chlorofluorocarbons, and nitrous oxide. The authors went on to forecast significant rises in global temperature and sea level if the world continued with business as usual. Calls to action accompanied the launch of the report, but fell on deaf ears. More than 30 years on, many of those ears, and quite a few new ones, remain deaf. Business as usual continues in most countries, and global greenhouse gas emissions have maintained, barring a small COVID-related downward blip in 2020, their year-on-year climb. In the interval between the publication of the IPCC's first and sixth assessments, the first part of the latter of which was released in 2021, total greenhouse gas emissions have risen by 43%, from a little under 35 billion tons to more than 50 billion tons. Over the same period, the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide has shot up from 354 ppm to 420 ppm, an increase of nearly 19%. Worse still, according to the US National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the warming influence of the whole basket of greenhouse gases has climbed a staggering 47% since the IPCC first appeared on the scene. This is probably the best place to reinforce the point that carbon dioxide is not the only greenhouse gas on the up. Atmospheric levels of other gases have surged over the past few decades too, most notably methane, which, as a greenhouse gas, punches far above its weight when it comes to its warming potential. Methane is produced by natural means, including releases from wetlands and ocean and lake beds. It is also a product of farting livestock, rice paddies, the oil and gas industry, and thawing permafrost, the enormous tracts of permanently frozen ground at high altitudes, all linked to human activities, which explains why methane levels have climbed 2.5 times since Arkwright's time. Over a period of 20 years, a ton of methane causes 86 times as much atmospheric warming as a ton of carbon dioxide. It is lucky, then, that it hangs around for much less time, so that only 250 kilograms would be left in the atmosphere after 20 years. Nonetheless, close to one-third of the warming since pre-industrial times can be attributed to rising concentrations of the gas. It is alarming to realize that when the warming effect of all greenhouse gases is taken together, it is equivalent today to an atmosphere containing 500 ppm carbon dioxide. If world leaders had taken purposeful avoiding action in 1990, when the IPCC launched its first report, we could be well on top of the problem now, with fossil fuels largely consigned to the dustbin, renewables dominant, and emissions under control and on the way down. But this never happened. Instead, despite successive IPCC assessments flagging the increasing urgency of the threat, serious action to tackle what is now, without doubt, an emergency situation failed to materialize. The fifth IPCC assessment was released in 2014 with the aim of informing negotiations in the run-up to the COP21 summit in Paris the following year. The meeting was hailed an unqualified success, at least by those involved. Amid much cheering and backslapping, the representatives of 146 countries signed up to the Paris Climate Accord, now ratified by 194 nations, which required them to submit so-called action plans for emissions reductions and promised to pursue efforts to limit the global average temperature rise since Arkwright's time to 1.5 degrees Celsius. These efforts, such as they are, have been ineffective. In August 2021, the IPCC released the first part of its sixth assessment report, Climate Change 2021, the Physical Science Basis. The remaining three parts are to come in 2022. This initial publication addressed the current state of our climate and what we can expect of it in the decades to come, and its timing was designed to inform discussion and debate at COP26 in late 2021. Because the contents of IPCC assessments are subject to political oversight by representatives of more than 190 nations, the findings presented therein are regarded by some, and rightly so, as being consensus-based and conservative. If anything, this made the conclusions of the latest report that much more frightening, and it is not an exaggeration to say that its publication changed the landscape of the global heating debate forever. This time, the IPCC pulled few punches and issued a blunt message. Due to the carbon already released by human activities, it warned, major climate changes are inevitable and irreversible on the scale of a human lifetime. Furthermore, in the absence of immediate, rapid, and large-scale reductions in emissions, limiting the global average temperature rise since Arkwright's time to 1.5 degrees Celsius or even 2 degrees Celsius would be impossible. Glasgow and beyond. For all the impact it had on negotiations at COP26, you might wonder if those involved in the summit had even seen the IPCC sixth report, let alone digested its terrifying message. Post-Glasgow, therefore, keeping this side of the 1.5 degrees Celsius dangerous climate breakdown guardrail remains practically impossible. Instead, according to the highly respected Climate Action Tracker, the world continues to follow a path, based upon current policies and action, towards a hothouse future that would see a global average temperature rise of 2.7 degrees Celsius by 2100. This is a best estimate, so the reality could be a bit cooler, or almost a full degree hotter. If the short-term pledges made in Glasgow were made good, the best estimate temperature rise would still be far too high at 2.4 degrees Celsius, the worst case reaching 3 degrees Celsius. Even if longer-term goals promised in Glasgow were also met, the rise would still be in excess of 2 degrees Celsius. While these hikes may not seem large, remember that they are global averages that, as I will discuss later, disguise the true picture. Be in no doubt, anything above 1.5 degrees Celsius will see the advent of a world plagued by intense summer heat, extreme drought, devastating floods, reduced crop yields, rapidly melting ice sheets, and surging sea levels. A rise of 2 degrees Celsius and above will seriously threaten the stability of global society. The depressing news is that, as of April 2022, none of the world's biggest economies, which together generate 80% of carbon emissions, are on target to keep the promises they made in Paris to stop the global average temperature rise topping 1.5 degrees Celsius. The UK, along with Costa Rica, Nepal, and a handful of small African nations, have made commitments that are almost compatible with achieving this goal, but they aren't there yet. Indeed, the UK is showing worrying signs of backsliding. Meanwhile, countries like Australia, Brazil, Canada, China, Germany, and the United States continue to develop fossil fuel infrastructure, making it impossible to achieve the emissions cuts needed to fend off dangerous climate breakdown. More than 140 countries have so far committed to delivering so-called net zero greenhouse gas emissions, meaning they will cut their carbon output significantly and offset the rest by planting trees or adopting some other means of absorbing excess emissions. Some have posted net zero targets that are so distant as to be almost meaningless, although more than 130 have coalesced around 2050. Even so, this is far too late. The global average temperature rise is slated to exceed 1.5 degrees Celsius within a decade, and there is, according to the UK Met Office, a 10% chance that at least one year could see this temperature exceeded by 2023. It now seems to be pretty much accepted by national governments that the world will overshoot the 1.5 degrees Celsius guardrail much sooner than even the earliest net zero targets. As a result, there is increasing talk of resorting to technological fixes to suck up any excess carbon still being pumped out by the net zero target year in order to attempt, eventually, to bring the global average temperature rise down to below 1.5 degrees Celsius. The problem is that such fixes don't yet exist at anywhere near the scale required, and, as I will discuss later, all those proposed are costly, environmentally damaging, risky, or downright dangerous. Most critically, many countries, despite being supposedly committed to achieving net zero by the middle of the century, have no roadmap to show how they will get there. Inevitably, this translates into a lack of serious action to cut emissions in the near term, up to 2030, showing up their longer-term net zero plans to be little more than a lot of hot air. Nasty surprises. While the world's climate scientists are making a reasonable fist of forecasting how far temperatures will rise and how quickly, getting it right is, due to the complexity of the climate system and the interconnectedness of its different elements, a huge ask. Even the most optimistic would agree that there will be surprises in store as our world continues to heat up, and probably not good ones. One thing that keeps climate researchers awake at night is the idea that we've passed one or more points of no return, or tipping points as they're known in the trade. Bringing temperatures down on an overheating planet is a bit like trying to turn the Titanic, and there may well be situations where, whatever we do in terms of slashing emissions, we can no longer avoid the iceberg. A good, and especially apposite, example is the Greenland ice sheet, the wholesale melting of which threatens a major hike in global sea level. At more than a quarter of a trillion tons a year, the current rate of ice loss is already astonishing, but there could be worse news. Some researchers think that we may already have passed, or be close to passing, the ice sheet's tipping point. This would mean that, even if temperatures stopped rising today, melting would continue to accelerate until Greenland was ice-free and sea levels around 7 meters higher as a result. This would not necessarily happen rapidly, but it would be baked in, and so ultimately inevitable. Then, there are so-called positive feedback loops. These involve responses to rising temperatures that act to heat up the planet even more. For example, as temperatures have climbed at high altitudes, so the vast areas of permafrost in Arctic Canada and Siberia have started to thaw. This, in turn, is releasing methane trapped below, which acts in a self-sustaining loop to reinforce warming. Another example is the progressive disappearance of Arctic sea ice. As our planet continues to heat up, so the area covered by sea ice reduces and is replaced by open ocean. Because dark water absorbs more heat than white ice, the more ice is lost, the more temperatures at high latitudes increase, leading to even more melting. There are plenty of other feedback loops too, all of which act to augment warming rather than suppress it. The problem is that the ultimate impact of such loops, and the timescales over which they operate, are not fully understood, so that their influence on how far global temperatures will rise, and how quickly, is poorly constrained. The lesson to take from this is that quoted forecasts for future temperature rises should be taken as minimum rather than maximum estimates.